We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host today, Ariel Garten. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. You can check out the Meditation Studio app in the App Store, where you'll find over 500 meditations on everything from sleep, stress, and anxiety to happiness, motivation, confidence, and so much more, all designed to inspire you to solve the big and little challenges we face in life and to be your best self every day. It's like having a little inspirational coach in your pocket. And we just launched two beautiful new sleep collections with music for you and your kiddos. Check it out. Today, join Muse co-founder, neuroscientist, brainiac, and Untangle co-host, Ariel Garten, as she goes inside the head of her amazing guests. Hello and welcome, everybody. My name is Ariel Garten. In every episode, we get inside the head of those who are skilled in the mental arts, neuroscientists, psychotherapists, people who understand how the brain works, how to optimize it, and how to manage the crazy in all of our minds. This week, we have not one, but two incredibly awesome guests. Dr. Olav Kriegelsen, he's a neuroscientist helping to understand decision-making and learning at the University of Victoria. He's extraordinary insights on some of the processes that go on inside the brain. And to have this conversation with him, we have Dr. Graham Boffin. Dr. Moffat is also a neuroscientist, and he happens to be the chief scientist at Muse. So Olav is one of our collaborators at Muse, and he's been using EEG to understand learning and decision-making in the brains of monks, professional baseball players, and astronauts. He's even taken this onto the Mars simulation. And as a very special thing, Olav took Muse up into the Himalayas to record data from dozens of monks meditating. And we're all going to be redoing that study because it was so fascinating. We're all going back, Graham, Olav, and myself, up into the Himalayas to trek to distant monasteries and to take EEG of monks to understand what happens in their brain during meditation. So this is a super special episode. We're going to dive into the brain, dive into meditation, and learn all about what goes on in the brain with Dr. Olav. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our sincere pleasure. So, first question, what's it going to be like on Mars?
That's a great question. I don't know a lot about that, but I know a lot about what it's going to be like on Hawaii right now. So the high seas Mars habitat is on the Big Island of Hawaii. It is in a red volcanic field, so it kind of looks like Mars, except for possibly the surf beaches off in the background.
Amazing. And so tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing there.
So yeah, we are collaborating with Kim Binstead and Gordon Binstead. Kim Binstead's a professor at the University of Hawaii, and she runs the NASA Mars Habitat Project, High Seas. And Gordon Binstead is a professor at UBC Okanagan. And the idea is basically, you know, when people go on long-duration space flight, they're going to have changes in mental state or changes in brain function. And the sort of the research question we're after is, can we track that? And that's where we're going to use a Muse. So we're going to use the Muse to track changes in brain function during simulated Mars missions.
And what are some of the hypotheses around how the brain might change on Mars or in space?
Well, right now we know that the people that have gone on previous high seas missions have experienced stress because they're in an isolated state for a long period of time. They've exhibited other cognitive symptoms. So the question is, when people have changes in brain function brought about by the environment, can we see that? So you could almost use an analog with like heart rate, which is you could imagine that someone's heart rate is roughly consistent day to day. But if they get some kind of heart condition, their heart rate might change. And you want to detect that and use that as a marker that something bad is happening. So we're planning to do the same thing, but with brain function. So we're going to track their brain function day to day. And we'll assume that when they go in, they're normal and healthy, which will be verified by an array of NASA doctors and scientists. And then we'll look at and see if we can detect changes over time, because we know that they will.
That's the great thing about brains, is they're always changing. So you know you're going to measure something. It's just a question of what it is you're going to find.
True.
So that voice that you just heard is the voice of Dr. Graham Moffett. Just to give you context, Graham is a neuroscientist who focused on auditory perception. Then he moved to be the managing editor of Frontiers in Neuroscience, and he's come to work with Muse for the last 4 years?
4 years.
Over the last 4 years, he's been understanding how to use novel tools to look at changes in brain state, specifically how you give people real-time feedback during their meditation.
Yeah, not just that, but also how far we can push Muse in new directions. So given that we have this very portable, very low-cost EEG system, what are some of the things that can be done with it, and how can it be used in human neuroscience? And Olav is probably the leader in deploying Muse in human neuroscience. So he's become one of our very close collaborators and a good friend of ours here at Muse.
Awesome. So Olav, what are some of the real-life situations in which you figured out how the brain works?
Probably the biggest project we've taken on is a series of projects, which is we got interested in cognitive fatigue. So when people are tired and their brain is tired specifically, they make mistakes. So we've taken the Muse into the emergency room of the Royal Jubilee Hospital here in Victoria to study fatigue in doctors and nurses and also in medical students. We've taken the Muse out into the workplace, and we've also taken it up to a mine in northern British Columbia to look at fatigue in miners. And in all those instances, sure enough, we found people that are tired. But the question is, can we then identify that and then potentially allow people to do something about it?
So tell us, what does the brain look like when it's tired? You know, we all know what it feels like when it's tired, but what does it look like in your brain?
So there's a couple of different ways you can quantify that. What we do is we have people play a video game, essentially, and there's events in that video game, and we measure their brain's response to those events, and we call that an event-related brain potential. And what's cool about this technology is these responses are reduced when you're tired. So you can imagine when you're rested and you played a game and your brain has a nice, large, healthy response to events in the game. And when you're tired, those responses are reduced.
And so how might that be used to create interventions?
So the way we're using it right now is we have people do the test multiple times to build up like a baseline or a profile. So you can imagine that your blood pressure, for instance, changes day to day a little bit. So we build up a profile of sort of brain response scores, if you will. And then when people get fatigued, their scores will drop below that baseline. And conversely, you can imagine they take up a new diet or start exercising, you can track those scores increasing over time.
That's really fascinating. So what are some of the other contexts in which you've noticed this phenomenon?
Well, the brain response we're talking about is evoked in everyday life. Like, it's basically a response to whenever you look at things. So, you know, if you're wandering down the street and you look at something, if you happen to be measuring EEG at that time, you would see this response. And that's what's kind of cool about it. It's just your natural response to seeing an object or seeing a person or seeing something appear on an iPad. And it's part of the normal visual processing chain that we see in people. And it's just different when you're tired.
So that's really fascinating. See, these are event-related potentials. They're kind of a signature that happens in the brain, a pop that happens in the brain whenever you see something that's salient to you.
Yeah, there's a whole array of them. You get, you know, different event-related potentials depending on what's happening. There's auditory event-related potentials when you hear things. There's visually evoked potentials when you see things. And within that, it, you know, it comes down to what you're processing. So, for instance, if you just see something appear on the screen, you get one visual evoked potential or a series of them. But if you give someone feedback, so you tell them that one won and lost in a gambling game, which is something we do a lot of in my laboratory, you get a different evoked response. So in that way, you can probe a whole range of cognitive processes like attention, memory, learning, decision-making, perception.
That's really cool. So within this conversation, as people are listening to it, what might be going on in their brains with regards to those responses?
Well, our understanding of these responses is quite limited at this point in time. So, for instance, every time you hear a sound, you're going to see a little squiggle in the brainwave activity, which is your attention system and processing. But it's not, we're not so far along as to say you can decode the word they're listening to or decode the picture that someone's looking at, although people are working on those problems right now.
Very cool. So people should just know that as they're listening, they're having little pops going on in their brain every time something relevant or salient responds to them, and their brain is filled with ERPs right at this moment.
Well, that's what's cool about EEG is that every time neurons fire, you get changes in the signal you see with EEG. So you're actually measuring neurons firing in the brain as opposed to inferring that activity, which is what some other techniques do.
That's really cool. And that is related to an experiment that you did with baseball players, looking at the optimal brain state to make the perfect pitch.
Yeah, that was a project done by a former master's student of mine, Anthony Pluta. Essentially, Anthony's an interesting guy. He comes from a professional sports background. He played professional baseball. And when I met Anthony, he asked me a simple question, which was, you know, coaches talk about being in the zone and players talk about being in the zone. And can we detect that with EEG? Like, is that a mental state that you can detect? And my first answer was, I have no idea. So what we did is we put an EEG system in use again. We put it on baseball players before they went out for batting practice. And then we quantified their subsequent performance during batting practice. And we found out we were able to predict how well they were going to bat based on their brain activity before they batted.
So this is super cool. And we've had previous episodes talking about flow and what flow looks like in the brain, how to get into the flow. Presumably, a baseball player that's hitting the perfect hit is somewhere in flow. They're in this like beautiful state where everything's just coming together for them.
You know, that sounds like what the baseball types would say. Now, all I really know is that what we found is if you look at a different frequency of brain activity, which is beta power, which is brain oscillations between 30 and 30 hertz, we found that increased beta power was associated with decreased performance, and decreased beta power was associated with increased performance. And some people associate with beta power with cortical arousal or cortical activity. So it kind of makes sense that the calmer or the quieter your brain is, the better you perform.
Yeah, and that's consistent, yeah. I think, with a lot of the behavioral sports research too on cognition and behavior in, you know, in expert level sports, where you look at higher levels of engagement of maybe cortical arousal, the equivalent of cognitive engagement, predicts better performance in novices but worse performance in experts.
Exactly. So yeah, our results lined up with a lot of previous work. In fact, even some studies with EEG, but there were only a few, and it was quite a limited environment, whereas we looked at it a pretty dynamic, open environment, which was literally batters on the field.
So basically what you're saying is a baseball player who's thinking less, who's cogitating less, is probably going to have better performance.
Based on the results of our study, that's what I would say. Of course, as Graham said, factoring in relative levels of expertise.
So an expert baseball player, and the idea being that once you've learned the pattern, once your body knows the pattern, once you know what to do, once you've done it 1,000 times, you kind of need to get out of your own way and not think about it, not overthink it, just execute the pattern.
Exactly. And that's actually, you know, this has been known for quite some time that, you know, back in 1967, Fitz and Posner proposed a model for learning with 3 stages. And the first stage is a cognitive stage or a thinking stage. And the second stage is an associative stage where you're sort of putting things together. And the last stage is an autonomous stage where things come automatically. And that aligns up well with what people are seeing, because overthinking is a sign of novice performance. And you could imagine if experts do it, it gets in the way, as you said.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
I was under the impression that in similar studies, you tend to see an increase in alpha activity when you have expert performance. So you see an increase in alpha, which suggests that they are still getting out of their way. They're not thinking, they're not cogitating. Is that something that you found as well?
There were a few hints of that in there, but not a lot in our data. But that is something that other people have seen.
So what is it that's changed neuroscience in the last, or changed in neuroscience in the last little while that makes it possible to get things outside of the lab, to do what you say, like bringing it out into the field?
Yeah, well, all of the technology has gotten smaller and more portable. You know, I think back to my first cell phone, which looked like something out of a bad 80s movie, right? Like it was a big brick with a big antenna and it weighed multiple pounds. And now my cell phone is a little tiny thing that slips into my pocket. Downstairs in my lab here at UVic, we have, I'm ashamed to say, a $50,000 virtual reality headset that we bought 9 years ago, which performs worse than a $600 HTC Vive. And EEG or brainwaves have gone the same way. You know, I've got $300,000 research grade systems in my lab, and portable technology is catching up. And I don't know if they'll ever replace it, but what's definitely true is portable neuroscience technology has increased in terms of quality and the data it gives immensely over the past 10 years.
And so what does that enable?
Well, it enables you to go out and do these cool projects, right? So if you had have told me when I finished my PhD in 2008 that you'd be able to put an EEG system on a baseball player, batting or in a Mars habitat or even taking it up to Everest Base Camp, I would have just started laughing and said, you know, well, no, you can't do that. And now it's relatively easy to do.
Amazing. So you've had the opportunity to look at what the brain does in real time and look at somebody's real brain activity in situ in some amazing scenarios. You've been able to look at baseball players, imagine what somebody might be like on Mars. And since you guys are close collaborators with us, you brought up an extraordinary opportunity. In May of this year, we're all going to be going up into the Himalayas, hiking towards Everest Base Camp to understand what happens in the brain of expert meditators who are situated in the monasteries there. So, Olav, can you tell me a little bit about what we have coming up?
Yeah. Over the past couple of years, I've developed some friendships with some people that do research in the Himalaya region, and it's altitude-based research. And we started planning a trip where we'd be able to go into this region to not only look at that, but also collect some EEG data from some Nepalese Buddhist monks. And personally, I just find that idea fascinating. So we thought, let's do this.
And so coming on the trip, we have some amazing neuroscientists who specialize in the neuroscience of meditation. And you have a number of research students yourself. And we're going to be tracking through the Himalayas from monastery to monastery and developing relationships within the monasteries when we're there and helping to understand what goes on in their brains during meditation and possibly afterwards.
Yeah, well, as you know, I'm interested in decision-making and learning, and mindfulness is supposed to, you know, facilitate that. So if you practice mindfulness or you engage in mindfulness activities or meditation, there's evidence that suggests it should enhance decision-making or enhance brain function at the simplest level. So I think it's a really cool concept, and to be able to investigate that in situ, if you will, in such a population will be fascinating.
With literal experts, I mean, I always get the question, what does a monk's brain look like? What does somebody who's been meditating for 50,000 hours plus, what does that look like relative to the brain of a non-meditator? And of course, it's a question that we chew on constantly here, that we try to understand and untangle. And we've had the honor of sitting with many expert meditators on mountaintops and monasteries and secular situations, but we've never had the opportunity to do it like this. So it's incredibly exciting and an honor. What are you most excited about?
I mean, I've never done anything really like this. You know, my background, the most interesting thing for me, and given my background, is I came into meditation via neuroscience. So when I was running Frontiers in Neuroscience, we published a special collection of papers on the neuroscience of meditation and meditators' minds. And so I actually adopted the practice on the basis of reading these papers and saying, wow, this is really beneficial. I should be doing this. Everybody should be doing this. So to come full circle back to that and actually go and get to do some of the science with people like Dave Fago and Olaf and have this incredible experience of going up to Tenbashe and hiking all the way to Everest Base Camp is going to be, I think, an unbelievable one, both scientifically and just purely from like an outdoor experiential perspective. I expect it will be culturally and just in every respect will be absolutely incredible and a lot of fun. And to get to do science along the way is a privilege that I think very few people are really getting their whole lives.
Yeah. I mean, Olev, when you brought it up, I was just overwhelmed by the thought. I literally almost cried. You know, we come from this rich, rich background of the 2,000 years of tradition that created this technology called meditation. Thousands, millions, hundreds of millions of hours that people spend applying themselves to this process of focusing their mind and honing their attention and then to the outcomes that it brings to the world. And Buddhism is really the seed of all of this tradition, the tradition that we follow and cherish and that we carry forward and that we try to create technology for to help people achieve similar states, but in this secular world. And then we follow the deep tradition of neuroscience. We're neuroscientists and engineers, and we follow the tradition of understanding the deep scientific perspective about what goes on in the brain. And to have the extraordinary marriage of those two streams high up on a mountaintop of meditation and deep neuroscience, to sit in a monastery with people who have devoted their lives psychologically and spiritually to this adventure, and people, the neuroscientists who've given themselves technologically to this venture, to have them meet together is extraordinary. Extraordinary.
You said it better than I could. Yeah.
I've been trekking in Nepal before. You're in for something special, that's for sure.
We're going to take a little break now to give a shout out to this week's pretty cool sponsor, Care Of. They are a monthly subscription vitamin service with personalized vitamins and supplements delivered to your door each month. You start by taking their online quiz that asks you about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices to find out exactly what you need. They also have nutrient-packed quick stick powders that can give you an extra boost when you need it. I just had my first pack delivered and I'm loving it. Head to takecareof.com and enter untangle to get 25% off your first month. That's takecareof.com and enter untangle to get your discount. Now, back to our show.
So maybe this is actually a good time to just pay a little homage to the neuroscientists who came before us and identified some of the processes of meditation in the brain.
What I find interesting with the meditation work is the broad range of findings, and there are definitely some consistencies in the literature, but there's also a lot of variability.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's definitely true. One of the unique challenges in the neuroscience of meditation or for that matter, consciousness studies more broadly construed, is, you know, there's no veridical ground truth that you can label your data with what your subject is doing. You're relying on self-report to a degree. And you can use various different kinds of tricks and tasks to try and measure when somebody's mind is wandering versus when they're focused. But there's a really difficult technical challenge to actually doing the cognitive neuroscience of meditation. And there's also this real incredible opportunity. And I think one of the reasons why so many people got interested in it was that it was an opportunity to explore some uniquely human aspects of cognition and of highly specialized cognition and the neuroplastic effects associated with it that we didn't really have a tool to explore before. So we saw that when the Dalai Lama spoke at the Society for Neuroscience, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, this was really sort of a coming out for contemplative science, scientific research, and a recognition of the contributions of the pioneers in the field. And now we're in a more mature phase.
I agree. And there's a really big parallel with, I always think of the parallel with visualization or mental imagery, yep. Which is when I was playing sports back in the day, people sort of scoffed at visualization or mental imagery. And now if you don't do mental imagery or visualization, you're sort of behind the curve because the neuroscience behind it is being proven. It's shown to activate your brain. And the same is true with meditation and mindfulness now, which is we're starting to understand how it's, you know, interacting with the brain and what, you know, what the neural signatures are. And it's kind of cool.
And one of the things that we're also seeing is that after meditation, you see potentially improvements in cognition.
There are definitely some studies that show hints of that. So if you look through the literature, you see that following mindfulness, you might get an enhanced neural response to something. And that's one of our goals of the trip to Nepal, is we're going to have expert practitioners meditate, and we're going to look at their neural responses to events, the ones we talked about earlier. We're going to look at them before they meditate and after they meditate, and hopefully see that pattern where you get this enhanced response following meditation.
Yeah.
Now, does that directly translate to better brain function? That might be stretching a little bit, but it's hinting at it.
And it's certainly something that we as meditators experience. Once you begin to meditate and you have your practice going for a while, you recognize that you're calmer, you're more focused. You recognize that your body is not as tense kind of all the time. You recognize your reactions have changed. You recognize that you can be engaged in a task for longer and longer. It's something that we understand as meditators, that there's this range of changes that happen. And obviously those range of changes are reflected in your brain. That is the thing that's allowing you, once you've been meditating for a while, to have these different experiences, better attention, changes in calmness. So if you could leave the audience with one insight about their brain, what would it be?
I would say that, you know, the things that our parents told us that are good for you help your brain. So, you know, the research in neuroscience, some of it in my lab, some of it, you know, in other labs, is shown that exercise improves brain function. And that's like, it's not a myth anymore. It's a truth because people have seen those effects. Diet impacts brain function. Sleep impacts brain function. I find the sleep research with EEG fascinating because they're sort of pulling apart that if you don't sleep enough, you're not going to form memories, right? As well as if you sleep less. And all of these things that we were sort of told, this is what you should do because it's good for you. It's getting harder and harder to not do them because the evidence is sort of become overwhelmingly in favor of doing these things. So I guess it's not really a short thought, but I guess my thought is that, you know, getting lots of sleep, eating healthy, exercising, and doing mindfulness training, these things have all been shown to result in positive changes in brain function.
You know, it's fascinating. Expert after expert that we have on the podcast essentially says the same thing. We had Dr. Dean Ornish on a few weeks ago, and his book, Undo It, is literally all about how basic changes, diet, sleep, loving connection, meditation, exercise can improve your life. They just dramatically improve your life across so many different fundamentals. So you've also started to apply this in interesting ways to understand how we make decisions. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we actually just published a paper this week. We're looking at how people make decisions, and specifically in this case, trying to differentiate between gut hunch decisions or intuitive decisions versus analytical decisions. So we replicated work by actually a Nobel Prize winner, Daniel Kahneman, and he showed in the 60s that you had a different pupil size when you made an analytical as opposed to a gut hunch decision. And that's sort of been a hallmark for trying to identify whether someone's making one of these intuitive or gut hunch decisions or a slower analytical decision. So what we did is we did this with EEG, and we were able to find that when people make analytical decisions, you get a different EEG signature than if they make gut hunch decisions.
How does a gut hunch actually work? We refer to the term gut hunch as if there's some activation in your gut that seems to result in an insight, but we're actually talking about a brain process. So what's happening? What's happening in the brain or in the gut?
The generally accepted idea is that for a given stimulus, or in other words, a given situation, you have a well-learned response, which is what you use. So you could use the stop sign or stoplight example, which is as you approach a stoplight or a stop sign, your intuitive decision or the preloaded response is to press the stop pedal because that's what you do. However, there's times where that might be an inappropriate response. You could imagine that it sounds like a bad Hollywood movie, but you're approaching the stoplight and you look in your rearview mirror and there's an out-of-control truck barreling down behind you. You need to process that information. So I guess the long-winded answer to your question is a gut hunch is just a reflexive answer given a situation. And if you don't want to have one present or the situation is challenging, then you need to exert cognitive control to come up with a better answer.
And where in our brain do these gut hunches live? So we understand this notion of cognitive control overriding a gut hunch and cogitating, but what's the mechanics of the actual gut hunch?
There's still a lot of speculation there. There's definitely a lot of midbrain structures like the striatum that seem to play a role in providing gut hunch decisions. But I'd say there's no target region. Like it's kind of the opposite of the cognitive control, where the prefrontal cortex is heavily implicated in cognitive control. To be fair, it's not the only structure, but the gut hunch is a little bit less localized, I would say. But it's definitely going to be more midbrain paths, systems that are providing a specific, just, you know, here's what you do in this situation.
Christoph Koch has this great metaphor in one of his books on consciousness. You know, what is consciousness? Which is similar analogy to, you know, gut hunch versus cognitive control, where he talks about, you know, you're basically on autopilot all of the time. You're reaching for things without really looking hard at them. And so his metaphor is that you're kind of being driven around, like you're in the back seat of an Uber, and every now and then you lean forward over the front seat and grab the wheel and change direction. But most of the time you're on autopilot, and you're sitting in the back being driven around by these automatic decisions.
That's a great analogy. I love that.
And so that brings us back to meditation and mindfulness, where a lot of what we're doing is we're strengthening our prefrontal cortex and taking yourself out of autopilot and then being able to actually have intentionality in your interactions.
Yes.
So in the world of meditation, we often talk about meditation leading to a strengthened intuition. And here we're talking about meditation strengthening your prefrontal cortex and your cognitive control and your attention. And there seems to be this sort of other thing that emerges when you meditate for a certain amount of time. It's something that you seem to be more in tune with yourself and the world around you, and it seems to strengthen your intuitions. I don't know if this is people's anecdotal self-report. Do you have any thoughts about this?
The only thing I can think of is, and both of you know far more about meditation than I do, but I know that in the literature that the data on this stuff heavily depends on type of meditation.
So maybe one way to look at that is as you get deeper into your meditation practice, part of what you're doing is you're becoming more sensitive to your own physiology and to your own reactions so that you can listen very closely to your body and its intentions and shifts, but you're also downregulating your amygdala. So your amygdala is often creating a lot of noise like, avoid this, avoid that. And so once you start to remove the noise of your amygdala's jump reactions and you begin to listen more sensitively to your physiology, there's another level of your body and mind's information that seems to arise.
Yeah, no, the amygdala is definitely implicated in decision-making, especially under stress, and then a lot of, you know, emotional reactions and physiological reactions. One of the things that I think is most interesting that Olaf and I learned on one of our research trips was we tended to think of continuous monitoring, continuous physiological monitoring via EEG as something that if you were monitoring vigilance or something, and decision-making on an ongoing basis, that you'd need to continuously measure and have somebody doing a task on and on. And the people we were collaborating with, so it was a branch of NASA that works on commercial pilot safety, training commercial pilots and cognitive and human factors and decision-making in pilots. And they thought about it very differently than we did when we actually talked to them about it. They were thinking, if we can teach meta-awareness, if we can teach people to recognize when they're likely to make a wrong decision on the basis of their gut, then they make much better decisions. And for pilots, this is when you, rather than reacting, you go to your checklist and you start to work through a cognitive list of, you know, where you are following a specific set of protocols that are set out to optimize your decision-making, as opposed to kind of intuitively reacting in a bad situation and making the kinds of mistakes that they know, based on all of the research, are likely to result from cognitive biases or false perceptions. So if you teach people to recognize when they are likely to make these kinds of decisions, this meta-awareness, then that actually can substantially improve your outcomes. And that is an outcome of mindfulness
practice. And meditation, yes.
That's how you put it all together. That's sort of the idea, because you two would probably know better than I do, but my friends in the corporate world are all interested in mindfulness now and meditation. And the idea is that these practices will help them make better decisions.
That's it. Can you tell us a little bit about why you like Muse and it's been an effective tool for you?
I do like Muse. The best thing about it is it just allows you to do cool research from my side of the fence. You know, I've got undergraduate students where I can give them a Muse and they can go out and do their own research projects. It allows us to ask research questions that people haven't been able to ask. You know, I just think of the last couple of years since I've been working with Muse, and if I make it a checklist, I've collected the EEG data inside an emergency room of a hospital. I've collected EEG data up on top of mountains. I've connected EEG data inside the Mars habitat. I've had students collect EEG data during rock climbing, hiking, you name it. And these are all things that if you had told me in 2008 what I'd be doing with EEG, I just would have said, no way, not going to happen. So I think it's the coolest thing about me for Muse is it's opened the doors to do all sorts of cool new research.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up doing all of these experiments and kind of how you ended up using these tools?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you'd have to ask your own research scientist, but when we first got our hands on Muse, we were curious to see whether you would be able to measure ERPs with a Muse, given the fact that it is a mobile device, and to be fair, given the fact that it communicates through Bluetooth. But lo and behold, you can. You know, it's a well-developed device, and the data quality is such that you can pull out an event-related brain potential with Muse. And that, again, opens yet another range of sort of research questions you can ask.
And can you talk a little bit about the papers that have been published and or are in press?
Yeah, we've got sort of published three major papers right now with about three submitted. The first one was to be validated Muse. So we put Muse head to head with one of our $100,000 research grade systems. And lo and behold, we got very similar data quality. So we thought that was important to demonstrate that Muse is measuring research-grade EEG. And that led us to our project. So we published Anthony's baseball paper where we showed that we used the Muse to show that you could predict batting performance based on brain activity prior to batting performance. And then the collaboration study with some friends of ours, we used Muse to look at the changes in the brain brought about by high-intensity exercise. And that's a paper we published a couple months back. And now we're in our fatigue era where we've got three fatigue papers that are, two of them are submitted and one's about to go out the door, where we're showing that we can use Muse to measure ERPs and then that those things are sensitive to fatigue.
So you have some interesting insights around exercise and the brain. And I know that's a place that I've been looking at a little bit. Can you talk about high-intensity exercise and how it helps? High-intensity exercise is all the rage. You only have to exercise for 7 minutes and it's going to get all your muscles going, then relax, then get them going again. Well, what's it doing in your brain?
In terms of what it's doing while you're exercising, the general consensus is that cardiovascular or resistance exercise increases brain function. And that's been, you know, known for quite a while now. With the high intensity exercise, we actually showed the opposite. But to be fair, we were measuring brain activity right after the bout of high intensity exercise. So what we believe to be true now is when you do high intensity exercise, you get this brief reduction in brain function, which is probably directly tied to you trying to recover from high intensity exercise. I don't know if you've ever tried one of these HIIT programs, but I couldn't make the 7 minutes. I made it to about 2.5. But then what we hope to see in the next study is that there'll be a rebound and that brain function will be, you know, on parallel with just regular, you know, your regular blast of 45 minutes on the bike or whatever it is.
So I do high intensity exercise every night, and I've certainly noticed a decline in my cognition immediately afterwards. And then an amazing feeling after.
I got that too.
Yeah,
I was actually one of the subjects in the original HIIT studies at McMaster in Marty Gabala's lab. And yeah, and I've still got the scars on my biceps from the, like, and from my legs from the muscle biopsies, you know, immediately after. And this is when they were still, this is when it was still, you know, it wasn't like, let's do 20 seconds. It was like maximal exertion until you can't. So I had a pretty strong decrement in cognition. Like a couple of times I passed out off the bike. So it was definitely not a lot of ERPs going on then.
So it's your physiology that we have to blame for this.
Well, they've optimized now. Now it's like 20 seconds of maximal exertion. It's not like 3 or 4 minutes of maximal exertion anymore. But it was, yeah. You can only torture undergraduates like that. I think you can't even torture grad students like that.
The one that I'm kind of excited about is my honors student, Kelsey, just showed me some data yesterday, and she was using the Muse, and she was testing people for brief bouts of exercise. So if you go for a 15-minute walk, does it help enhance brain function? And what's cool, lo and behold, 15 minutes is enough to do it. But she got this cool effect where the enhancement was even greater if you did your walk outside as opposed to inside. So we were looking at people that, you know, ride the bike or that kind of thing. But it was, in this case, just walking. But we thought it was kind of cool that just getting out for your noon walk is better for you than walking around inside a building.
Well, I imagine, just a spitballing hypothesis here, possible change in temperature when you go outside allows you to become more alert. The sunlight, the shifting landscape causes you to become more alert as you look for potential danger. You know, as a result, you're bringing all of your systems online. The systems that kind of turn off or become inured when you're in an average interior office environment.
It's definitely, there's a range of explanations. We controlled for heart rate and intensity and the things you'd expect to control for. But, you know, when you go from walking around inside the hallways of a building to walking out, and in this case, it was through a little forested area on campus, definitely environmental differences drove a lot of that. But I still think it's cool that we can scientifically say you're better to go for a walk outside at lunchtime.
One of those things that, you know, the things that you've always heard are good for you turn out to be actually good for you.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom with us today, for bringing us inside of your mind.
Thank you for calling it wisdom. I appreciate that. And thanks for having me on the show.
Our complete pleasure.
And Olav is that neuropsy guy on Twitter.
And you can check him out at olavkrigelson.com, olavkrigelson.com. And for anybody interested in this Muse thing that we've been talking about, you can get real-time feedback on your brain and know what happens during your meditation. Know when you're in focused attention and know when your mind has wandered in order to help you begin or enhance your meditation practice. You can just find it at choosemuse.com. I'm Ariel Garten. You can find the full episode with all of our babblings and wanderings about the brain at arielgarten.com, arielgarten.com. You can find out more about Olav at olavkrigelson.com, as mentioned. And next week, Patricia will be back with more Untangle. Till then, keep meditating, wondering what's going on in that noggin of yours, and keep your neurons sparkling. Oh, and if you want a discount code for Muse, because you're curious about it and you want to check it out, you can find it at choosemuse.com and use the code UNTANGLE15.